This is the second part and in computer interfacial motions in imaging and vision. So here is the outline for today. We'll start with a 1 minute review of the level set method. So that's a bit of an exaggeration, but not much. So it will be maybe a few minutes. I'm speeding up a little bit because I understand that a lot of people might be familiar with the basics anyway. But I'll try to indicate some maybe finer points and tricks, okay, along the way. Then what I'm going to do today is review the level set method applied to the Chen-Weisei piecewise constant Mumford-Shah segmentation method, and then describe its connections to the total variation denoising model of Rudin-Oscher and Fatemi. In particular, we will see that the Rudin-Oscher-Fatemi model for denoising can be used to solve in a globally optimal way the segmentation functional of Chen and Weisei. So, and that relates to some work I did with Tony Chen and Mila Nikolova back in 2004 actually. So, the overall theme is in keeping with last time. The denoising models and segmentation models are actually closely related. Last time we saw that paranormalic is actually nothing other than a gradient descent method for Mumford-Shah, the full Mumford-Shah piecewise smooth version. And today we will see that Rudin-Oscher-Fatemi, the total variation minimization method, is the denoising method is actually provides a way to solve the segmentation problem. Okay, so level set method then, very, very quickly here, the idea so was proposed by Stan Osher and Jamie Sethian back in 88. So if you're going to evolve a curve in the plane or a surface in space, for example, which is likely to undergo topological changes, then a very nice way of doing this is to represent the curve or the surface as the, let's say, the zero level set of a function phi. So for example, if you have a circle in the plane of radius r centered at the origin, then you can represent it as the zero level set of this upside down paraboloid. And, or of course, you can also represent it as the zero level set of this cone. Right? So of course, the level set representation is not unique. You can represent the same shape by many level sets. But this provides you a very easy way to represent the geometric shape in terms of a function. Okay, so, and the advantage becomes clear once you start to evolve these things. So for example, suppose you had the union of two circles as your initial contour and that's evolving in space. Perhaps it's represented by this level set function. And then suppose the dynamics leads to the curves to grow and touch each other and merge. But if you represented the curve using some explicit methods, like explicit parameterization or something like that, of course, it will be very difficult to make that transition. You have to do something very special to handle that issue. But with the level set function, it's just rising, right? So it's if you represent it as a level set function, it's very easy to represent such complicated topological changes, which occur automatically. Okay, so that's the main draw. So in the talk, I'm going to use the convention that the zero upper level set, okay, is going to be the set of interest. So the curve or surface and so on is going to be the boundary of the set. And the set inside the set, the level set function will always be positive. It's negative outside, of course. So basic set operations can be described very easily using the level set function. So for example, if you have two sets, sigma 1 and sigma 2, one of them represented by phi 1, the level set function phi 1, the other one represented by level set function phi 2. If you want the level set function for the union of the two sets, you just take the maximum of the level set functions pointwise. Taking intersections is also very easy. If you want to take the intersection of sigma 1 and sigma 2 and find a level set representation of it, you just take the minimum of the two level set functions. And of course, complements also very easy. You just negate the level set function. Okay, so some other basic things we use all the time. So suppose I want the indicator function, the characteristic function of the inside of the set sigma, where sigma is represented by the level set function phi. I can just represent that by composing the level set function phi representing sigma with the Heaviside function. So that becomes precisely the characteristic function of the set sigma. Unit outer normal to the zero level set represented by the level set function phi is simply given by, of course, the normalized gradient with the minus sign, because my convention is that the level set function is positive inside the set. If you want to, for example, express the area of the set sigma in terms of the level set function, you can just integrate the Heaviside function composed with the level set function, because then that's just the integral of the characteristic function of sigma, which gives you its area in the plane or volume in space. And if you want the perimeter, then you can just take the total variation of the characteristic function of the set, which is written here, of course. So it's very easy to do all of these with the level set function. Okay, so now here I'm going to include the slides online, of course, so we don't have to go through these, but a very basic calculation in the plane at least shows you that the if you want the curvature of the level set, then actually it's given by the, you can check the divergence of the normal vector, unit normal vector field, which is expressed here in terms of the level set function phi. And this formula gives you the mean curvature in higher dimensions. Okay. So, okay, but the level set method is of course particularly useful for moving interfaces, as I just noted. Again, a very simple calculation shows the following. So suppose now you have a curve which is going to be represented by a level set function phi, but suppose the function is, this curve is also evolving, then your level set function phi is going to also depend on time, of course, right? And suppose you want to move your curve by a certain outward normal speed v sub n, right? So this is the speed of a particle on the front, but you project it onto the normal direction, v sub n, then that's v sub n. Suppose that's given to you, then how do you do that with the level set representation of the set? Well, you just say evolve your level set function phi according to this PDE, right? So if phi represents your set at time zero, right, when t is equal to zero, then it will represent your set evolving under this motion at a later time if you just define your function phi for later times by solving this this partial differential equation. Okay, so example, outward motion with some spatially varying speed. Okay, suppose you have a curve in the plane and you want to evolve it in the outward direction by speed given by a function g of x. So wherever the curve happens to be, right, it measures what g of x is at that point and then moves in the outward direction by the speed. The level set version is going to be simply this. So vn is g of x here. If you wanted to do, for example, motion by mean curvature, right, v sub n is equal to k for a surface, let's say, then the level set version is just going to be simply given here because this divergence of grad phi over norm grad phi, as we saw, gives us the mean curvature of the set represented by the level set function phi. Okay. Okay. Now, you can try to derive these basic expressions in a different way, too. So you can say, for example, why don't we try to obtain the same fact by variationally? So because, you know, as we saw last time, okay, with very elementary calculations, if you want to do gradient descent, okay, for an energy of this type, so you have a set sigma, which is the unknown, right, and you're integrating over sigma a function g of x dx. Suppose I want to decrease this as fast as I can by evolving the set sigma. So how would I do that? As we saw, when you go through the calculation and calculate this, how you should update the boundary of sigma, you find that actually you should update the boundary of sigma by the speed. Okay. That's where it came from. Now you can say, well, another way to derive the level set equation for this flow then must be the following. I can first express the energy in terms of the level set function and then take variations with respect to level set function phi. So if I want to express this energy in terms of a level set function phi representing sigma, it's given here, of course, right? It's integral of g of x with h of phi because that's a characteristic function of sigma. Now you can take variation with respect to phi, right? So you look at E of phi plus a perturbation delta phi, and you get it here, you expand it out, okay? So from this calculation then, you get the impression that, oh, okay, so I'm sorry, this should be phi sub t. So phi sub t should be whatever is multiplying delta phi in this calculation. So we're getting h prime of phi multiplied by g of x. Not quite what we expected, right? Because we should have gotten norm grad phi multiplied by g of x. Why do we get this instead? Well, it's a very simple point. So here, we got confused a little bit. What we're doing here is calculating this variation in the bulk, right, by making perturbations to the level set function del phi in the entire set volume that it represents the set. Whereas before, of course, this variation, the speed was calculated with respect to an inner product on normal vector fields on the surface or curve that is represented by phi. So, and here's the point. Suppose that this black thing is the original level set function phi of a function, okay? And then if I perturb it by adding it to that a delta phi, a perturbation, let's say it raises it, right? Then you ask yourself, you know, what we are measuring here is the vertical, right? So how much this thing went up. But what we should really be interested in is how much the front moves, okay, in the horizontal direction. So a delta phi perturbation in the bulk translates into a delta phi over norm grad phi perturbation to the geometry in the normal direction. So we have to take that into account, which is a simple point. So here's the corrected way of doing that calculation. So when you take variation with respect to phi, right, you just try to expose, right, whatever is going on in terms of the geometric perturbation, right? So you try to write down the perturbation as an inner product of the geometric perturbation times something, and from here you can read off that the correct equation that you get is right here. Okay? So this is a simple point, but it can be confusing actually. And actually, you'll see that it was responsible for one of the very lucky things in image segmentation. I'll show you in a second. Okay. Okay. So, second example, you can try to do the same thing with, of course, curvature flow. So here, as we saw before, curvature flow, mean curvature flow, arises as gradient descent for the perimeter surface area of the set. But of course, we can express the perimeter of the set in terms of the total variation of the characteristic function of sigma, which is given in terms of the level set function phi as h of phi. So take variations with respect to phi. Keep in mind that what we talked about, of course, you're really interested in measuring the size of your perturbation, not in the bulk, but as a perturbation on the curve, right, the geometric perturbation. If you keep that in mind, then indeed you will arrive at this equation. Okay. Okay. Now, a few simple facts about, since this is a tutorial on, and I'm talking about level set methods, just to indicate, so how do you discretize something like this? A typical discretization will be to take the right-hand side and expand it out. Okay? So you expand out this divergence form and then multiply by norm grad this term and so on. So this is going to cancel one of the grad phi terms in the bottom, right? And then the denominator you can discretize by centered differences. Also, for stuff on the top, you use centered differences. So for example, whenever you see phi sub x, you use a centered difference, and second derivatives, you see centered differences, etc. This will actually give a second order accurate discretization, but it actually has its problems. And it's, by the way, it's recommended by many textbooks, but you'll run into some issues with when you do it this way. So for example, if you have a curve that shrinks to a point and you discretize the right-hand side of your mean curvature flow this way, and in fact, you'll find out that curve never shrinks to a point, but then never disappears. So, in fact, if you expect, for example, I mean, if you're just computing the motion of a smooth curve for a short time, then this is a very accurate and good way to discretize things. But if you expect components of your curve to disappear and so on, then actually it has some issues. So I personally prefer starting with a discretization of the curvature term. And the way I like to do that is, since it arises as the L2 gradient descent of this total variation term, I start with a discretization of the energy that it came from. So I write down a very simple discretization for the total variation, right, like this, and then take variation of the discrete energy and just keep everything in divergence form and just follow your nose. It's a very simple calculation. I find that this works better. It's first order accurate, not as accurate as the previous thing, but when there are topological changes and so on occurring, I find that it works better. Okay, but whichever way you do it, you will run into the issue that if you try to compute with this thing, mean curvature flow, there is a quite strict stability condition on your time step size. Delta t will have to be at least on the order of h squared, okay? I mean, at most on the order of h squared, and it might actually have to be smaller because you have to regularize the denominator here. So you have to take lots of small time steps, but actually there's a nice trick for speeding this computation up, and this is the analog of what's known as convexity splitting, and it was proposed by Peter Smerikov. So if you want to compute the mean curvature flow by a level set equation very quickly in an unconditionally stable manner, here is a very simple trick that you do. Right, so k is the time discretization step, so k plus 1 is the at the k step. So on the left-hand side, I have a very simple forward Euler discretization, right, of the time derivative. And then on the right-hand side, the right-hand side of the level set equation is discretized in a very simple forward Euler manner. I'm not writing down the spatial discretization. We already discussed that. Then you do some very simple trick. You add and subtract a Laplacian of phi, okay, to the right-hand side. But the term you added, Laplacian, you evaluate that at the next time step, k plus 1. The one you subtracted, you evaluate at the current time step, k. And of course, as your time step size goes to 0, these two terms should essentially cancel each other out, right? So it shouldn't matter. But if you rearrange terms a little bit, what you find out is that this is equivalent to updating your level set function phi in the following manner. So if you were just doing standard explicit time stepping, you wouldn't have this operator here at all. You would just get phi sub k plus delta t times this discretization, explicit discretization of the right-hand side of the mean coverage equation. What this does, essentially, adding and subtracting does, is actually you take that right-hand side and you apply some sort of a smoothing operator to it. And what nobody has proven this, but it appears to be unconditionally stable. So you can take arbitrarily large time steps, and it works very well. In practice, I found that it's very stable. But you have to be a little bit careful, because when you do this, for example, you do lose something. So actually, because of this non-local nature of this operator, for instance, you will lose any kind of a maximum principle. Okay, so in fact, you can construct some strange examples where, for instance, this way of computing might introduce new connected components, okay, and so on. So it should be used with care, but otherwise, in practice, you don't really see that, and then it works very, very well. Okay. So how do we compute then, let's say, a motion given by this velocity law, right? Normal speed equal to some epsilon times curvature plus g of x, right? Because we'll run into this kind of motion in a second. Then, of course, it's given here, right? Based on what we have just discussed. Now, in these computer vision problems that we have, typically this epsilon is not going to be zero. Okay, you'll always have some sort of penalty on, geometric penalty on the surface area and so on, which helps a lot, by the way. So if epsilon were zero and you were just computing the motion by some constant growth by g of x, actually, with the discretization of that, you would have to be much more careful, okay? And I don't have time to get into that. You would have to do upwinding or no schemes and so on. The fact that we have usually this parabolic term helps a lot, so we don't have to be that careful, typically, okay? So you can just go ahead and discretize, for example, this term in a very naive way, and this presence of a little bit of a diffusion is going to save you from disaster. Okay, yeah? Oh, so for example, in geodesic active contours, it will be something coming from the underlying image, right? So, could be, okay, so typically, of course, it will be a, let's say, not necessarily a continuous function or something like that, right? So, not, okay, so it could be discontinuous, I suppose, but anyway. Okay, so let's see. All right, so I can skip that. Right, so now let's just apply to the geodesic active contours, the version that was proposed by Kichinasami and so on, which fixed the parameterization dependence of the original version. So, of course, that can be expressed in this way, right? So you want to integrate the boundary of a set, right? The curve is given as the boundary of a set. You want to integrate length, but there's a weight, g of x, that comes from the underlying image. Again, we calculate the L2 gradient descent, etc., and we come up with this equation. And the computations I showed you last time were done by this method. And as I told you, of course, it's extremely likely to get stuck in local minima and so on. So this, in practice, I don't think turns out to be a very good way to do that. And I'm sure Ron Kim will tell you the better way to do it, but I'll allude to it as well. Okay, now let's go to a precise constant Mahfouz-Shah model of Chen and Vese and review how to do that with the level set method. So based on what we just discussed, we can write it down very easily. Right? So as we saw last time, if you derive the normal speed of the interface that is doing gradient descent for this energy, imagining that C1 and C2 are fixed for now, you can update them concurrently. That's easy to do. The normal speed of the interface is going to be given like this, okay? Because these two terms are the bulk energy type terms, right? Integral of some function g of x over sigma and its complement. They lead to these spatially dependent constant outward speed. And perimeter gives you mean curvature, of course, or curvature in the plane. So the level set formulation of this flow would be precisely this, okay? But that's not what Chen and Vese did, in fact, back in 2000. what they did is, in fact, they did the variation in the box, okay? So in fact, that little thing that we have to be careful with, right? Which, I mean, you can interpret that as a mistake in some sense, right? So if you blur this distinction between measuring the size of the perturbation to the level set function in the bulk versus measuring how much of a perturbation it is to the actual geometry, right? If you miss that point, actually you'll get this one. However, what they noticed is that this version works so much better actually than this one, okay? So in particular, this one, right, nucleates new components. So what that's relevant for is the following. So if you have an object that you're trying to detect with, let's say, a hole in it or something like that, suppose it looks like an annulus, and you take a curve that's encapsulating it. So suppose your initial sigma is the interior of this dotted curve, right? Then if you try to segment that object from the background using this flow, what you will see is that this curve will shrink and wrap the outer boundary of this annulus, but you will never be able to detect the interior edge, okay? Because in order for you to detect this, right, you would have to nucleate a new component, which is very different from being able to handle topological changes, right? So this version, for example, if you had two objects, right, and you initialize a curve like this, it will be able to actually split into two pieces and give you these two boundaries, okay? That's very different. I mean, by you can introduce a second component to the curve as it touches itself and pinches off. Here, what would really have to happen is a component of the curve would have to appear all of a sudden, even though it's not close to the original curve, right? So, yeah?
What would happen if you just do EQ or
maximoid or whatever to the original histogram and then just move it with
the
media filter?
Wouldn't you use practically that?
Which one? This one or this one?
The function on the top.
Right. So this is a question about the model. How useful is the Chan-Wessel model compared to, let's say, if you did what? Say it again.
Uh-huh.
Right. Perhaps. I'm not aware of any rigorous way to actually show that you will, by at some limit or something like that, of those procedures, you're going to actually capture the minimizer of this. But I'm not sure. Okay. Okay. Anyway, also I should point out that there are other versions of this model proposed by Wessel and Chen with more than two regions, segmenting with more than two regions, which can also be dealt with using the level set method very easily. Okay, but what I'd like to point out is the following. So it's not so clear why the difference between these two is so stark. This one nucleates and this one doesn't. In fact, you can show that this one cannot nucleate by some maximum principles and so on that hold for this flow. It will never introduce a new component and allow you to find additional features like this one. So why does this allow you the nucleation? That's a little bit confusing, right? Because it's a small change. But I think it was confusing for a while, and I think one can give a complete explanation. Okay? And in fact, I can relate to what we did with Tony Chan and Mian Nicolaou to a complete explanation of what's going on here. Okay? So in fact, we will consider a slight variant of this, which you can show finds the global minimizer, okay? All right, so PD-based methods for finding global minima. This is based on joint work with Tony Chan and Mian Nicolaou, and also subsequently with Bresson and others. It's based on the following works that I did back in 2004, and then in 2005, extension to the active contour snake model. Okay, but this requires going back to the Rudin-Oshur-Fatemi model, okay? So I will come back to Chan-Wessel, this question about why one of the forms nucleates, the other one doesn't nucleate, and I will give that explanation in a little bit roundabout way by going back first to the Rudin-Oshur-Fatemi's image denoising model that is given here. So compared to some of the previous techniques we discussed, models that we discussed, like paranormalic and so on, right, you can consider this to be, in some sense, a certain limit of the paranormalic, right, where you take these convex, concave function, energy densities, and then let the concavity become less and less, and you, at some point, you're going to get, you know, borderline concave, convex energy density, which will give you basically this energy. What Rudy Noshu Fajemi notices is, of course, you don't need that crazy concave behavior at infinity for your energy density to capture sharp edges in your minimizers. You can actually use just the total variation, which is nice and convex, and still gives you minimizers with discontinuities if there need to be discontinuities in them. And they have many advantages over, for example, paranormalic. This is a strictly convex functional. Existence, uniqueness of solutions, and so on is trivial. It has continuous, so the solutions have continuous dependence on data, also on the parameter lambda. So then also, compared to the other things like paranormalic, there's only one parameter to be chosen by the user. That's the lambda, which can be related to the noise level and so on. Of course, there are still some difficulties, and there is a lot of very interesting research that's been done on dealing, for example, numerical minimization. Its numerical minimization is not easy at all, because naive numerical methods turn out to converge very, very slowly because of the non-differentiability, among other things, of this functional. So I'm not going to get into any of that. And one should also say, as a denoising method, it has been superseded by much more successful techniques these days. So, like non-local means and even more recent techniques, I guess, they do much better as denoising methods than this one. Nevertheless, this is a great functional to play with because it's simple enough. And also, it's related to, as we will see, piecewise constant Mumford-Shah. It will allow us to solve it in a globally optimal way, manner. So here is how we got around. We arrived at that conclusion. So I will tell you what we were thinking of. I think an interesting way to analyze these models is to ask the following question. Suppose I give you what should be considered by any reasonable person as a noise-free image. So, for example, characteristic function of a set in the plane with very nice smooth boundary. Okay, I mean, that should be basically a noise-free image. There are no oscillations or anything like that. So you might ask, okay, what does the denoising model do to it? Does it deform it or does it keep it fixed? Right? So the question is, what images are exactly preserved by the Rudin-Oshu-Fatemi model? And if you ask that question, and Ime Ayer did this a long time ago, the answer turns out to be that basically nothing. Okay, you need your image to be a constant image. Okay, all other images will be degraded. So it finds noise where it shouldn't find any noise. Okay. So, for example, a long time ago, Tony Chan and his one of his students, David Strong, did this calculation for a disk, and they see that if your given image f is the characteristic function of a disk, okay, which I call sigma here, then the solution turns out to be the same thing but multiplied by a constant between 0 and 1. Okay, so you lose the contrast a little bit. Okay? Otherwise, the boundary is kept the same. So to get around that difficulty, we proposed a very, very simple modification of the Rudin-Oshu-Fatemi model. We said, well, why don't you just replace the L2 squared fidelity term by just the L1 norm? What that buys you is that this functional then becomes contrast invariant. So suppose you solve this minimization problem for a given f, and you get the solution u. Okay? Then if you do it again for psi of f, where psi is a contrast change, so it's an increasing function mapping R to R, then the solution of the transformed image is going to be the same transformation applied to the solution. Okay? So that's a useful thing to have. People look for that in image processing models, at least some people look for that in image processing models. And what you find out that is that this contrast invariance basically implies that you're going to leave many clean images invariant. Yeah, you're fixed. So if f, for example, is the characteristic function of a set with whose boundary is smooth, so no oscillations, then in fact the minimizer will be equal to exactly f, right, the given image, provided that you choose your fidelity constant lambda large enough, whereas the original ROF would always lose some, no matter how large your lambda is. Okay, and as we'll see, this leads to, so we later recognized, right, that this also leads to algorithms for finding global minimizers of shape denoising and segmentation functionals. So PD-based methods, I should say. So basically it also comes from just the contrast invariant, this very basic property. So here is how we actually noticed it. We said, okay, I mean, this is very suggestive, right? You're not losing any contrast here. So it's very suggestive. If it's contrast invariant, it must be processing every level okay, individually. Okay, and if you have a characteristic function as your given image, for example, then it must be doing the same thing at every level, right? So it must be basically solving a geometry problem for every level, and that geometry problem should be the same for every level curve of the given image. What that means is then, on the other hand, it's a convex function, right? So what that so that line of reasoning led us to the following. So if you have a binary observed image f of x, okay, suppose you have a binary observed image, and you want to find a denoised version. But what that means is you want the denoised image to be also binary, okay, so 0, 1. So what you can do is you can take the Rudin-Oshel-Fatemi model and, of course, restrict the minimization to characteristic functions of sets. Right? So now I take u to be of this form, characteristic function of a set sigma, and the given image is the characteristic function of another set omega. Okay? Suppose I want to regularize the boundary of that set or something like that. Then, of course, this you can rewrite easily because this total variation of u then becomes just the perimeter of sigma, and this term can be written as the area or volume in 3D of the symmetric difference between sigma and the given shape omega. Right? So it becomes a very simple geometry problem, which was considered using level sets by Oshel and collaborators before. However, it's a non-convex optimization problem, of course, and in general, the global minimizer is not going to be unique, but more troublesome is that you're going to get caught in numerous local minimizers if you try to solve this problem, for example, with level sets or something analogous. So here is just explaining to you what might happen. So for example, if you do standard level sets or, you know, standard implementation of snakes and so on, then you can, of course, keep components that you should remove. You might not be able to remove a small dot, let's say. Okay? Also, you might not be able to find interior contours and so on. Okay? So this was, of course, known by Tony Chen and Luminis Avese for their modified flow that it somehow seemed to get around these difficulties. Okay. Okay, so now it's very easy. A very easy claim argument now shows you that, in fact, you can find the solution of this using this total variation with L1 fidelity. Right. So here is what you need to solve, what you need to do to solve this geometry optimization problem. Okay, so to find any minimizer, so basically you, instead of solving this problem, you solve this one. You find any minimizer of the convex energy, right? So this is the total variation problem with L1 fidelity and the given image, the characteristic function of omega. You minimize it over all functions u, right? So no constraint on being binary or anything. And call the solution found u star, which might not be binary, actually. And then you take any one of its super-level sets where mu is between 0 and 1, and that has to be a solution to the original problem, okay, so this geometry problem. So you can solve a convex problem, so you're never going to get stuck in local minimizers or anything, and you'll obtain a solution for this. Okay, so the proof is based on a very simple, two very simple formulas, the co-area formula for the total variation, and the layer cake formula, which, if you put them together, tells you that you can write that this whole energy, okay, in terms of the upper level sets of the function u, okay, and the upper level sets of the given function f. But you know, of course, when f is the characteristic function of omega, this is always going to be the same set omega for all mu between 0 and 1. So the integrand, right, is always the same geometry problem that we were trying to solve, right, this one, applied to the different super level sets of u, okay, and summed up. So to minimize this, of course, you just have to minimize the integrand. Right? Okay, so of course you don't want to minimize just the integrand at every mu. That will be solving the geometry problem. But if you minimize the sum over all the level sets, that has to automatically minimize the integrand at every mu. Okay? Otherwise, it couldn't be the minimizer. So that's the argument written down here, a very, very simple one. And you get the conclusion that, in fact, each level set of the solution of the minimizer has to solve the geometry problem. Okay, now I should point out, so this idea, okay, of writing a non-convex problem as a convex problem using the total variation, for problems involving total variation, using the co-area formula, goes back, okay, to a lot of people, in fact. And the earliest example I could find is due to Gilbert Strang, okay, for a problem in plasticity, where he studies this problem, okay, and shows that even though the minimization over all functions u, the minimizer turns out to be automatically a characteristic function. Right? So it's something you can imagine it as some sort of a relaxation of a binary optimization problem. And these are papers from 83, and these two papers. Okay. Now, what really, I suppose, is application of this line of reasoning, to in the specific instance of, as you will see in the Chan-Wessel model. Okay, so that's what I'm going to get to. But let me show you what happens with this just binary denoising, right? So if you have something to denoise that's like this with lots of holes and everything, so if you find the minimizer of E1, this Rudin-Oscher-Fatemi with L1 fidelity, actually it's, we cannot guarantee that it's going to be a characteristic function, but in all instances, computationally, it turns out to be a characteristic function. For example, here, it's very close to being characteristic, but even if it weren't a characteristic function like this, don't worry, just take any of its super-level sets, and that's going to be your solution, guaranteed, right? So, and when you do gradient descent, right, that's what we do, start with initial data that was empty sets, right? So, and this is the evolution that you see for the function u, right? So, starts with a zero, and then becomes, at certain places, it becomes one. And here, just showing you that you have to go through some non-binary images to get to the global minimizer, which at the end turns out to be binary. These are the histograms. Okay. Okay. So how do we generalize the piecewise constant Monfort-Sha? Right. So first of all, how do we notice that? Now here is the piecewise constant Monfort-Sha. This is what we did. So I mean, that was the next question we asked, of course. Recall Chan and Wessel's level set formulation, right, which is given here. This h of phi, h prime of phi, is troublesome. It's a it has a complicated dependence on phi. So here's what you do. Drop it. Okay, so drop the non-convex h prime of phi term. Then you get this flow. Okay. Now, then ask yourself, what does this flow correspond to? What's the energy that this is minimizing? Well, it's just given here. Right? It's very easy to integrate it back up to the energy. This gives you. This comes from total variation. This comes from this very simple bulk energy term. Right? But now you look at this and say, ah, but this cannot have a minimizer, right? Because of the homogeneity in phi, this couldn't have a minimizer. You couldn't, if you thought you found a minimizer, you could multiply it by a constant and get an even supposedly better minimizer or something like that, right? So because it's homogeneous of degree one in phi, the level set function phi that you're minimizing over. So you say, well, okay, but that's not a big problem. Just put some sort of a constraint on phi. Phi should be between 0 and 1, right? So that's a convex constraint, right? And this is the convex functional. And there you go. So as it turns out, now you can generalize, right? If you minimize this functional, right, with respect to u, then in fact you guarantee to find a global minimizer of the two-phase Chan-Wessel, provided that you know what the two constants are, c1 and c2. Otherwise, you have to, of course, update those as well, right? So, but the geometry optimization can be written in a convex way. And what do I want to say? Yes, and basically all we did is the following, right? So how does it relate to Chan-Wessel? Well, if you do gradient descent for this, ignoring this constraint for a second, which you can, you know, do projections or so on if your phi ever exceeds this limit, the flow looks very much similar, except that we got rid of that h prime of phi. Right? So I would say it's not quite, so we cannot quite show that the Chan-Wessel original formulation finds the global minimizer, right? But there is this slight variant, right, which we can fully prove that converges, gives you the global minimizer. Yeah? No, because this could be negative. Right? At certain places, it will be. Right? If f is better approximated at a location by c1, right, then at those locations, phi will want to be 1. Right? So, but then as it increases, it will hit the ceiling, right? And then other places it will hit the floor, and you get this binarization of the minimizer. Right? So, okay. Okay, so in conclusion then, by making a modification, right? So you can show that actually, so by the way, of course, this works better because that h prime of phi actually slows you down. There's no point to do it that way. If you are going to do it by gradient descent, why not just do this? Okay. So here are some examples. I have a given image to be segmented. Okay. So this is the kind of evolution that you see here. You start with, let's say, all black as your initial guess. It doesn't matter. Eventually, the function u grows and becomes a characteristic function. And here's the stationary state reached, which already looks characteristic. But once again, as before, even if it weren't a characteristic function, you would just threshold at some level, and that's essentially guaranteed to be a global minimizer of the Chan-Wessel. Okay. Now, there are extensions to multiphase, right? Because two-phase segmentation perhaps isn't as interesting, right? So
Another annoying question.
Yes, of course.
If you not affect the C function and you threshold it,
yes,
you get different answers to different threshold.
You can, because the original geometry problem might have non-unique solutions, right? So it could possibly happen. Right? You can construct examples of that, okay? But, okay. Yeah, but you could force, I mean, I imagine it would not be hard, okay, to, for example, add a term or something that will always give you, let's say, the largest solution or something, right? So you could restore uniqueness by doing something like that. And I think somebody did that. I cannot recall now, but I think Wotao Yin might have written something about that. So either the smallest or the largest is unique or something. Okay, I forgot. But yeah, you could do something along those lines. But anyway, I mean, if there are multiple solutions, right, it might be beneficial to know what they are, actually, all of them at the same time. Right? Okay, now you might want to do multi-phase segmentation, and I know of at least one paper by Chambaud which sort of does that, but so U is now, okay, so it's of this form, so now U, the function U is not just 0, 1, it can take values in a finite set of values, okay. So then you can minimize, you can carry out the same sort of thing for this. Okay. It does the segmentation into K regions, but you have to notice then, you ask yourself, okay, but what kind of a Chen Vese or Mumford-Sharp model does this correspond to? And what you know, what you discover is that this, if you can really write in this form, that means you're weighting the boundaries between regions in a very unequal way. Okay. So in particular, they have to be additive like this. So it's not just the perimeter of the the surface area of the interface, right, separating sigma I from sigma j that you're summing up. You find the surface area and multiply it by a constant. And what is the constant you multiply by? It's wij, okay, some constant wij. And those wij's are related to each other in the following way, right? So the multiple of surface area, right, that you're using for the interface between phase I and phase j is equal to the sum of the weights that you used between IL and LJ. Okay, so that's a very strict requirement for this extension, at least. And for more general, for example, equal weights for measuring the different interfaces, the length of the different interfaces, there have been recent works by Schnur, Chambaud, Kramers, and Polk on computing the convex envelope for the equal surface tension, equal weight original Mumford-Sharp model, piecewise constant Mumford-Sharp model. But as far as I know, they're all approximations. You don't quite get the convexification of the original multi-phase Mumford-Sharp. Okay. So by the way, this basically says, right, your surface area, right, your function U, right. So the surface areas should be written in as a total variation, essentially. Okay, so this corresponds to precisely being able to write down the sum of the surface areas separating the different regions as a total variation of a function. Right? So that's what's required. Okay, now let me just mention also extensions to geodesic active contours, which we did with Xavier Bresson and Stan and so on in 2005. So here, the model is up here. Again, remember that you're given an original image F, and you want to find the edges. So what you do is you define an edge detector function, right? So g of x here, right, indicates where the edges are because it's small when you're near an edge and close to one elsewhere. And so, of course, if you try to minimize this, then your curve wants to go through locations where this g of x is small, because then it gets weighted very low. Its length elements get weighted very low. But I showed you what happens, right? It gets stuck. It's very easy for it to get stuck. And there was, of course, a technique for finding the global minimizer in some sense for this model, which really makes it usable, right? So, for example, you can pick two points on the boundary, P and Q. Then, instead of, for example, minimizing this by gradient descent over curves that connect P to Q gradually, you can say, look, what we're trying to find is we're trying to find the shortest path between the two points P and Q in some weighted distance, with respect to some weighted distance. So why don't we just do it the way that people usually do, find the shortest path, you can solve the iconal equation, and then of course once you have, so you construct a distance function in this weighted distance from P to everywhere, and then you can essentially start at Q and do some sort of a gradient descent to go get back to P, okay? And that's guaranteed to, of course, give you the globally optimal path connecting P to Q. So that's Cohen and Kimmel, of course. But as far as I know, you cannot generalize that way of doing it. So with Hamilton-Jacobi, right? You cannot generalize it to higher dimensions, as far as I know, because... But there were some papers back then, like around 2005 and so on, where people would try to construct a surface this way, right? I mean, the analog of this is clear, right? So if you had a, you could also pose the same problem, like you measure the surface area, but there's a weight, right, coming from the underlying image. How do you do that? Well, so people were trying to slice them, okay, and do it one slice at a time. You do it by this technique, right, find the curve, and then sum up those curves and whatever. But actually, with our formulation, it's very easy. This is the convex version, right? So g of x multiplying norm grad u, still a nice convex functional. Okay, so I should say, sorry, remember, of course, in this model, you don't want to find the global minimizer because that would be a point. So here, for example, a very sensible thing to do is to put a constraint. Your curve should start at P and go to Q. Okay, so we have to do something about that. I don't really want to find the global minimizer, but here's one thing you could do, for instance. You could say, well, instead of asking the user to pick two points, for instance, you can ask them to paint some regions which are contained in the object of interest and then solve this, okay? This minimization, integral of g of x norm grad u, u is restricted to between 0 and 1, and it is constrained to be 1 at all the places that the user indicated. Minimize that, and then you're going to get actually global minimizer of the active contour model, and of course directly generalizes to any dimension. Or we consider this case in our paper, you can add fidelity terms as in the Chan-Vesey or Mumford-Sharp model, to make sure that you know, you don't get a point as your global minimizer, of course. Right? So this eliminates the problems of getting stuck in local minima. Right? So I should mention, of course, there are experts here in terms of graph cuts. There are graph cut methods for finding these global minimizers as well for these segmentation models and so on. And I'm sure somebody talked about them. Right? So however, as far as I know, with these graph cut methods, on a rectangular grid of pixels, for instance, there's always going to be an anisotropy in the primitive term. Okay? If you want to capture, so if you want to minimize something like Mumford-Sharp with the isotropic primitive term, with these graph cut techniques, then you have to increase the connectivity of the graph by introducing edges in various directions, so you have to include larger and larger neighborhoods of these nodes. So, what I'm trying to say is, imagine what Tsitsiklis and Sethian did for Dijkstra, right? So they showed that you can capture isotropic Euclidean length without increasing the connectivity of your graph, right? As far as I know, there is no such thing for this graph cut business. So if you want to capture, approximate the Euclidean length and stuff like that, you have to increase the connectivity of your graph. Now, you can ask the same question about what happens when you do this, do it this PDE way by writing down gradient descent for something like this. Oh, any dimension, right? So you minimize this energy, right? And then, of course, suppose in three dimensions, right? So you have a function u defined everywhere, you find a minimizer. It will most likely turn out to be a characteristic function, but even if it's not, you take any one of its level sets, which is going to be a nice surface, and that's guaranteed to minimize geodesic active contours of the following version, right? So the way... No, so, okay, of course, let's just write down the, let's just go back to the original, right, in terms of curves, right? So if I try to minimize this without any constraint, I will get a point, right? The global minimizer is a point because nothing. So here, for instance, so it's necessary for this model to put some constraint, right? So, of course, for example, your classical way of doing it by now is to pick two points on the boundary. Now, people have elaborated on that too, right? So for example, they said, put a cut or something so that you can choose, I think, only a single point, and then that's enough. You force the curve to go along or something like that. I mean, there's a whole bunch of ways to elaborate on this as well. But it's necessary to put some sort of a constraint, okay? Another practical constraint would be, right, instead of asking the user to indicate a point or a couple of points on the boundary, you ask them to indicate a few pixels that are contained in the object, okay, so clicks. Actually, that might be easier for the user, I don't know. So then you can say, okay, now I'm going to minimize this, okay, over closed curves, which are required to contain the points inside, the points that the user indicated inside, right? So that's also reasonable, I think. But again, if you try to do it with gradient descent and so on, that will be difficult because it will get stuck in local minimizers. Now, but that version, right, we can find global minimizer for in any dimension. So in the higher dimension version, you would have exactly the same kind of energy, except of course now you're going to be finding the surface area here, weighted by the same thing. The user, let's say, indicates some points that are contained in the object, right? And then you can find the global minimizer by just doing this optimization. Right? Okay, I should.
Yeah, but then write the function out that the integration already
implies. Okay, I should point out this is 2005. Okay, so in between? Oh yeah. So let me go back at the end because I mean it's the second slide or something like that. So I'll show it. Yeah. Or of course you could put Fidel's terms, right? So which would be another way to prevent this things becoming a point, right? So I mean you could write this plus fidelity terms. Like that could be your way to prevent. So perhaps you know that the object you're trying to segment is close in some intents to something, and then outside is perhaps close to something else, then you can do it. All of those. So if that's the case, then you can minimize this convex functional. Otherwise, you can minimize this convex. I like this version a lot, actually. I mean, it sounds like a reasonable thing that a user can do, right? Pick a few points, and then you don't have to go through this, I mean, I remember this. I don't know if that's what Cohen was doing, but somebody I know was doing slices and so on, and then it was looking complicated anyway. So all you have to do is this minimization. Now, let me go back to what I was saying about these graph cuts, which I'm not an expert, but Jerome Darbon is here, for example. He's an expert, so please do point out if I'm making a mistake by saying these things. But so as far as I know, you cannot capture an isotropic length without increasing the connectivity. On the other hand, you can ask the same question, okay, for PDEs. You can say, look, the way you're going to do this gradient descent for this thing, right, for instance, you have to discretize total variation term. And that U, right, is going to be a characteristic function. It's discontinuous, right? So how are you going to discretize it? If you use some standard forward differences or something to discretize the total variation term, well, on a grid, if you evaluate that thing on a 0-1 function, you're going to get terrible anisotropy, grid anisotropy as well, right? So that's a very legitimate concern. So then you might say, well, if you really wanted to capture the isotropic length, you would probably have to use more elaborate finite differences with more neighbors and so on. But surprisingly, that turns out to be not the case. Okay? In fact, Brad Lucier and his student have a paper that shows, no, you don't have to do that. Okay? You can approximate on every grid of size h. Okay? You can approximate, you can just use these very simple forward differences, and as the grid size h goes to zero, you will in fact recover the isotropic perimeter. So you don't really have to increase the connectivity, so to speak, right, with this approach. Even though solutions are characteristic functions. Now the subtle point here is, after you discretize and minimize, okay, the solutions are not exactly characteristic functions. They'll be slightly blurred characteristic functions, and that's what actually Lucier is using, right? And that slight blurring is precisely what allows you to capture at the end the isotropic length. Okay, I think that's pretty much the end of my talk. So let me go back to the beginning and show you the references. Oh, actually, there's some there. It would be. No, this paper. Okay. I think I'm right. We have 3 minutes for questions, I guess. But that's it. Thank you. Yeah.
How would you optimize it if it's derived instead of just the method that you've shown at the beginning with the epsilon? And,
Certainly. For example, so let me go back to the end. How do I go to the end? Okay, that's easy. Oh, darn. Okay, yeah. So here we can partially see it, right? So to minimize this, of course, right? You might say, well, you have to put an epsilon into that square root. But as we know, I mean, for example, Antonin Chambaud's duality-based methods, there are ways to minimize total variation terms without regularization. Right? So you could do that. So duality, right? So play. Let's go back here. If you had something like this to minimize, in fact, that's what we did in this paper that I just showed, right? We used Chambaud's duality method so that you can minimize without regularizing the total variation term at the bottom. Yeah? Say again? Okay, yes, that's true. Yes. Well, I think more likely it's in a medical image or something you might write, so MRIs and so on, I guess, can be three-dimensional. But of course, you have for a dog, you have to know where the hydrant is. Yeah.
Any questions?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
I know about the main part, but let's go back on the TV noise. You went from L to this, or up to the TV to the L one.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's not just for convenience. It's for contrast invariance, I guess. That was the main motivating factor.
Yeah.
So perhaps we messed up the performance of the model on images with Gaussian noise because the L2 fidelity term would have been the more natural fidelity term to use with Gaussian noise. That's a legitimate point. Sure. So maybe it doesn't perform quite as well on removing Gaussian noise, for instance. You're right. But the point was just contrast invariance for us. And then eventually the point became this global minimization. But, right.
And like, mm-hmm. I really much that you want like denoting a bit of fixed point of like but can you put like the content on front of the TV term and just put it to zero and get think that doesn't
Yeah, so in other words, you can send lambda to infinity, right? That's what you're saying. No, but I prefer, right, that there should be a range of lambdas, not just at, not when you put 1 over lambda in front of the total variation when it's 0. No, for small enough, there should be a threshold. And when lambda is below that threshold, right, so like lambda star, if it's between 0 and 0, lambda star, you should get exactly the same. That's what I want. Not just a specific value, but the nice range, so that I don't have to work very hard at finding that or something, right? So, yeah, that's what we're aiming at. Yep. It must be a mistake. Then but this is written as. Okay, look. That's quadratic in U, and what was bothering you was that this is linear in U, right?
Always.
There's a difference. Okay, I mean, you could rewrite this also in quadratic way, I suppose, yeah, but... Yeah, Jerome. Not sure. It's a little too philosophical. So different ways of discretizing subtle variation term, which would... I see. Right. So what if you did use a different finite differences formula, right, to approximate this? What would happen? That's a good question. You might lose gamma convergence. I don't know, right? It's possible. I think actually Lussier did look at that. He considered some fancier type of discretizations people sometimes use, right? Some, I don't know, upwinding or whatever they say. So that sort of thing, right? So I think in his paper, actually, it's for a slightly more general class of, I don't remember now. At least he was looking into this kind of issue, as far as I know.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. If the Courier formula was... Well, no, it's not quite. That's a valid point, too. And the fact that the Courier formula is wrong, right, allows you to, actually, that's necessary. Because if the Courier formula was right for this discretization, then you will get a perfectly characteristic function as your solution, and then there will be no chance of capturing... I mean, it will be just like graph cuts, and then there will be no chance of capturing the isotropic length, right, in the limit. You'll really get the cab driver, or actually here it's not the wolf shape is not square, it's something a little bit more complicated, but I think it has six sides or whatever, right? You would get some...
Metrication error?
Okay, so...